Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. I hope you're enjoying our pre-shiur talks. We're referring to Dr. Shapiro's fascinating read in the Sfarim blog that just came out. I think it came out on Friday, but I didn't see it till after Shabbos. Anyways, you can take a read, but welcome everybody as we continue our series, Torah Motion series on the rise, the rabbinic response to the rise of reform. I want to thank Lottie Dessau, who is sponsoring this evening shiur in memory observance of the Yortzeit for her mother. Neti, Deso, Shoshana, Beth Moshe, the Neshama should have an Aliyah. We should have long life and come together for good occasions and on Smachot. Thank you very much. Okay, Dr. Mark.
Vakasha. Okay, hello. Thank you all. The date is March 28th, 2022. Good to be back again. Yes, as Rabbi Kalman said, we're continuing on the rise of reform. I think today we'll finish with the reform, and then we'll begin, I think, with what the Gedol Yisrael's response to that. I have a lot of piles here, so I'm just going to get right into it, pick up on some things which I wanted to get to. The first thing, not relevant to the classes, but relevant to the previous semester, I just have to share something because... I think it's just interesting what's going on here, but hold on, let me pull it up. I spoke a bit about Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky. So hold on a second. Oops, no, that's not the one I want to show you. I want to show you a different one. We'll get to that in a second. Okay, now let's see if it works. Yes. You might remember, actually, before I do show you that, I want to show you, let me show you something else. You might remember last semester that we dealt with, we dealt with Shaul Lieberman, and I told the story of him and Rav Chaim Kanievsky, the letter he wrote. Here's the letter. In which he recommended Rav Chaim Kanievsky for a prize. And then I read how there's a whole discussion there that someone said this is not Bakovodik. He said he's greater than his father. And then they argue. And then Mr. Saul Lieberman was a conservative rabbi. And then someone says about me, Mark Shapiro is a renowned heretic who delights in ridiculing Chazal. And someone responds, purveyors of historical truth on heretics. We went through that whole thing. What I said is that everyone, this was already 2,000 years ago that this letter was traveling around the internet. But this group, the yeshiva website called Matzav, at least they attributed it to me. But they made it seem like I published it on Matzav. They didn't say where they took it from. It comes from the Lieberman archive. I published it on the Sfarim blog. Okay, fast forward. Chaim Kanievsky passes away. And this letter is going around. About 15 people have emailed me saying, have I ever seen this email and have I ever seen this letter? And these are people who read the Sfarim blog, which, you know, I remember it, but a lot of people don't remember it. In fact, someone who's listening to us right now, who's even with us in the classes, he emailed me this today. It even appeared in the Jewish press, someone put it, and they credit Aryeh Rotenberg. Aryeh Rotenberg, I don't know who that is, but he must have got it in his email box and passed it on. No one remembers Mark Shapiro other than Amatzav, that I'm the one who put it online, and it's not the first time. We already saw the picture of Shaul Lieberman in his tallis. The same thing happens, but let me record it for posterity. But I think some of you remember that. And with Chaim Kanievsky was such a unique style of learning, and the amount he knew. So people are finding this fascinating. Get rid of this. Moshe writes to me. I confess my Ashkenazi tendencies here. I said in the class that what did I say here? I said someone asked me about drums on Shabbos, and I said, "What's the problem with drums? You can't be metaking it." And Moshe is correct. He points out that the simple reading of Masachas Beitza, 36b, is, it says, where is it? It says explicitly that you're not supposed to do it. Yes. You're not supposed to clap your hands, clap, let's say, on your leg, nor dance. Now, we don't follow that, Ashkenazi, because we have Tosos that says that we don't know how to anymore. You know, we're not experts, the typical person, in fixing instruments, and therefore the hope there's no problem. You see, you couldn't dance because then you might bring an instrument and you might break, say, you might fix the instrument. That's not a concern anymore. We all dance on Shabbos, especially if we have a Sheva Brachos. But I made it seem like it's not a big deal at all. Well, maybe for us Ashkenazi, but the fact is that the simple pshat is it is a problem. And Rav Avadya Yosef in Yechav Adas, volume 2, 58, he goes very much against all of us Ashkenazim and says it's absolutely forbidden to dance. He quotes the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan quotes the Tosfos that I mentioned, that we're not Bikim. And then he says, he gives another reason, that in the days of Chazal, they would dance al pi seder hashir, but today we're dancing and we're only singing, so it's not an issue anymore. And he says that our dancing is not like the olden dancing. Our dancing is not like rikudei nashim, which I guess means organized dancing or something. He says our dancing is rikud b'li seder. We just go in circles. So that's, I think, what he means. And Rav Avadya says that he calls this divrei nevius. So the archbishop just made this up. So thank you, Moshe. You are correct. And then Moshe points out that his wife is a proficient balat tokeya. I think she should be balat tokeya, I guess. No, Baal Tokeya, you're right. And then whenever we have company, Rosh Hashanah, she can't get the shofar, she blows for herself and the rest of the ladies in the house. And I act as the makri. Because he says the only authority who has a problem with a woman using a shofar on Shabbos is the Shagas Aryeh, and he is against all the Rishonim, and some it's better for a woman to blow herself than to hear it from a man. I think he means using a blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Okay. Rabbi Kelman in the last class asked about the Bahag. So I looked into it a little, and lo and behold, the Rav speaks about it. The Gemara is explicit. Where's I pulled up? In Arachin. That's what Rabbi Kelman was referring to. Hakol chayvim b'mikra Megillah, hakol k'sher krosis Megillah. And why do you have to teach this? To include women. The Gemara says, and that's the Gemara. I can't get around the Gemara. But the Bahag, the Tosfos quotes the Bahag as saying that they can't blow for men. They have a little different responsibility or requirement, even though that's not the Pshat in the Gemara. And that the Rambam and others, they all hold like the Gemara. The Rav in Rishimos Shirim, Masachas Sukkah, believe it or not, Lamed Ches Amud Aleph, he takes up this Bahag, if you want to check it out, Rabbi Kelman. He quotes a few opinions, including his father and himself. He quotes, the Rav says that there's two kiyumim by Megillah, Talmud Torah, because you're reading Kriyas Kisvei HaKodesh, and Pirsum HaNeish. And the men are obligated in both. The women are only obligated in Pirsum HaNeish, and therefore they're not Motzias HaNashim. And he elaborates on this. His father gives a different shot. He quotes the Turei Evin, and so it has been discussed.
And it's all made up. That's
it's Farah. He's trying to explain the Bahag. Right. He never would have said this without the Bahag. Right.
That's correct.
He's trying to explain the Bahag.
Right. The Pashtun is they can read for men, of course.
Well, the Gemara, it's obvious they can.
Yeah, correct. That's all I was saying. Okay.
But apparently the Tosefta seems to say otherwise. So for some reason, the Bahag is using the Tosefta. I wanted to get to the where is it? I'll get to the Bat Mitzvah. Okay, a couple more things though. Thank you, Mendy, for the following. I want to show you another thing here. I got to stop, but I have to share it again with sound. Well, first I want to show you music. You've seen this in America. It now comes out once a month. The Mizrahi has a newspaper. A magazine. It's the editor of it is Rabbi Eli Michel, who went on Aliyah. He was the rabbi in Livingston, New Jersey, near my house. So I'm looking. It's all devoted to the Renaissance of Jewish music in Israel. And there's a picture in here about I don't know if you can see. Oh no, actually, I found it online. So let me show you online about this Kehilas Shiras David. So here you see guitars and playing and davening. But then it gets better because Mendy sent me something, and I gotta let me now share this. I think you'll like this. Most of you, the purists, might not like it. What he's sending me is from the yeshiva in Jerusalem, Simcha Shlomo. I guess it relates to Shlomo Karabach, but watch this. I thought I was enlarging it for us. I pressed the wrong button, but now I know how to enlarge it, because when you watch it, I'd like to have you see it. This is going beyond what we've seen so far. Yeah. So you see, it's thank you for that. Spurgeon, the conservative rabbinate, approves of it. Population. I told you I'd get you this. So let me show you the population, the chart. Where do I get this chart? I'm going to show you the two charts from. Let's see. You see here. Here's one page. Well, actually, this you don't see it as well as I want to show you the numbers. There's a book by Simmels. See her Simmels called Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Very helpful book. And this is the numbers he has. And he explains in the book where he gets these numbers from. So if you look in the year 1170, it's approximate, obviously. I don't know the last two of them. He has an exact number. I don't know where he's just put together some census. But the Jewish population is 1.5 million. And Ashkenazim, we think, are 100,000. And Sephardim, look how many Sephardim there are, much more. And what happens is around the around the 19th century, beginning even and moving in, the Ashkenazic population explodes. And the Sephardic population stays pretty much the same. I guess you can attribute this to better medical care, more, you know, lowering mortality rates. That's how I guess here's another chart that I'll show you. The Sephardic population is at the bottom there, and it remains the same, and the Ashkenazic population simply explodes. Okay, I already see it's 8:45, so I'm going to hold off again. I keep saying this. What I have to do, but I want to, you know, this has to be Tufel, and we have the Ikar. I want to get back to Yaakov Hadron, the meaning of it. I promised you. I guess I'll get next week. I am going to speak about Bas Mitzvah and what that has to do with confirmation, and more about Hecha Kedusha. It'll see. I'll explain to you when we get to it. The Rav's view, which I follow, I now think it's a minority position. But whatever you do is okay. Okay, let's pick up where we left off. Lots of interesting things here. I'm holding. In terms of reform, I have this document here: the ritual, the reply of the chief rabbi from 1892 in London. Because you had a lot of pressure in London to make reforms. Now, this is this is like 80 years after the first reforms, and the people pressuring for this were members of the traditional community. They weren't so necessarily observant, but they're in the United Synagogue. And I think you'll, when you see the response to the Gedolim, put into context, I think you'll find it interesting what Rabbi Adler, and he wasn't one of the Gedolim Yisrael, but he had a Beis Din of fine Talmidei Chachamim, and I'll show you what he permitted and what he was asked. He didn't permit very much. They asked for like 40 things, and he permitted just, seven or eight of them. And he also says in the introduction, he has a letter here, I can send this to anyone who's interested, that he says that the Chazanim should avoid singing of an elaborate character. Not sure what that means. But listen, some of the things I thought were fascinating. He begins speaking about, about a minyan. That many of the shuls, if they didn't get a minyan Shabbos morning, what they would do, or not to Shabbos, but speaking about Shabbos in particular, they would leave. You don't get a minyan, your minyan didn't come, you daven by yourself and you leave. He says otherwise. He says the supposition that in the absence of 10 male worshipers, divine service need not and should not be held in the synagogue is entirely erroneous. He goes on and says that if you don't have minyan, you continue davening with a chazan. You just don't say Kaddish, he says, in Baruch Hu. But then he says, listen to this. The scroll of the law should be taken from the ark and the prescribed portion read without any kruim. The Haftarah should also be read but without the blessings. Never heard of this before, that if you don't have a minyan, you take out the Sefer Torah and you just read it without calling anyone up, and that you read the Haftarah. He permits that, he permits following the practice we saw, which they did in Berlin, of based on the fact that the Sephardic congregations in London and Amsterdam also have gotten rid of Chazaras HaShatz. For some reason, the shuls didn't like Chazaras HaShatz. They wanted to get rid of it. He says you can get rid of Bama Madlikin. He says you can get rid of Bama Madlikin if you really, they wanted shorter service. The reason I think the service is so long is because they had Chazanim, and the Chazanim would drag it out. So you get rid of Bama Madlikin. He permits an early service on Shabbos and festivals of either 8 or 8:30. I guess they started davening 9. He says that two sections of Pichamak Torahs can be omitted. No one's going to miss Pichamak Torahs, I guess. And every page is like four or five things, and he keeps saying, absolutely not. You have to say this. You have to say this. I'm just reading the things he agreed. They asked him if on Yom Kippur in Mincha, they could get rid of the Torah reading. Today, people ask to get rid of it because it speaks about homosexuality and other things, but they thought it was improper. In Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, you're going to talk about the sexual matters. And he says, absolutely not, that we have to inculcate on the most solemn day in the calendar the great duty of sexual morality. And then he keeps going on. They ask to sound the shofar on Shabbos. And he says, this cannot be entertained. It's contrary to our law. They said that at the end of the Yom Kippur, no Myriv, because I guess people want to go eat, if they not to have Myriv in Shul. And he says that he doesn't agree with that. But he says you could start davening Myriv before it actually is over. Not like we do. We wait till Eva. Start davening Myriv, and then you'll read the shofar afterwards so that you'll finish really right at the end when it's Havdalah. And this is something that's a real reform. Rav Moshe would not like this. I know this. He says, under the chuppah, everything has to be done appropriately. However, in addition to the things that are done, the normal procedure, you can add the following. The minister, the one who's leading the service, can say, will you, Pony, take this woman to be your wedded wife? Will you be a true and faithful husband to her? Will you protect and support her? Will you love, honor, and cherish her? And the bridegroom says, I will. And then he says to the woman, if they want, Will you take this man as to be your wedded husband? Will you be a true and faithful wife to him? Will you love, honor, and cherish him? And she replies, I will. I've never heard any Orthodox wedding do that. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's weird. And then in the end, he lists some slichos. Some Gedalia, you can get rid of one of slichos. Yom Sheni of Aseres Yemei Tshuva, you can get rid of Tocheles Yisrael. Yom Shlishi, so he gives you one slicha of the slichos you can get rid of. So a very, very minor reform. It's not like we've seen, not like we'll see now. What we're going to look at now is Aaron Lieberman. I mentioned him already that he is a bit of a, he's a bit of a scoundrel, this Aaron Lieberman. According to Gretz, Gretz would know, he ends up converting to Christianity. And he's the one who put together this volume, the Nogah Tzedek. And then he added his section called Or Nogah. And really two sections of it. He, as I said, he was in Berlin, he was involved with the reformers, and he lists the eight accusations made by the Orthodox, who are going to be called Orthodox, against the reformers. And we see most of them, not all of them. One, they ordain that the prayers be said in German, and he's going to respond to all these. Two, they abolish Silent Shemoneh Esrei. Three, they omit the Kedusha in the morning Shabbat Shemoneh Esrei. We'll see what this means. Not the entire Kedusha. Four, they use the organ. Five, they introduce Sephardic pronunciation. Three, they read the Torah without trup, and they don't call men to the Torah by name. Seven, they violate Otis Kodajin. That is, they're making separate communities. And eight, they transgress Altitosh Torah Simecha. That is, you can't change the custom of our ancestors. Lieberman basically responds the same way as Horan and the others. He quotes what I said last week, the Ma'arik, that there's a... Well, I think I quoted in that Shmuel Abuha, but same thing, that in Salonika there was a canon for the women. He did it in the vernacular. Regarding instrumental music, he again cites sources that music was used extensively, all the same things that appear in Recanati and Chorin. We know that the Psalms were accompanied by music, so he says this isn't a new custom. Regarding the Sephardic pronunciation, he repeats what we saw in Chorin, that this is the better pronunciation. Regarding reading the Torah without trup, which is a problem. One of the people emailed me this week, I think it was Moshe, that the Gemara itself speaks about this, as I said, but also you can determine the meaning of psukim based on trup. But he says that we don't know how Moshe Rabbeinu read the Torah. So he said you should read each section of the Torah in accord with the mood. So if it's a sad section, read it like sad. There was a man, he passed away, but a couple years ago, but he used to read Megillus Esther he read on Yom Kippur Yonah. And he read Yonah in accord. He did the trup, but he acted it out, basically. He says, today we don't appreciate the trup of the Rishonim because we speak differently, and every country has a different trup. So it says there's no requirement in trup, and it can be abolished. Why you want to abolish, I don't know. Regarding omitting, what does it mean to omit words of the Kedusha? Well, he explains on page 13, he says that Kedusha, the only thing that's Kedusha we know about is Nekadesh and the things later. But he says, Oz B'Kol, for example, that's not part of Kedusha. He says, Oz B'Kol B'Kedusha Shabbos Lo Nimtzakal B'Misadrei Tfilos. He says, Eza Ish, a certain person, who we don't know who he is, he invented it. So these extra things that you have in the Kedusha, which are not part of Naritzcha or Nekadesh, the extra things we throw in after that, all that stuff, he says, that's not part of the original, and we can get rid of it. Regarding calling people up by name, he says, there's no halacha anywhere that says you can call up someone by name. And he proves this by citing tshuvot that say that if you don't call up by name, you can call two brothers in a row. And then he concludes as follows. Well, he answers the question, what gives you the right to abandon our minhagim? Al titosh Torah simecha. And he says as follows. He says, he says, you ask me why we can abandoned practices that we have because the earlier generations didn't do it. Who gives us the right? And he quotes a Gemara. I'll show you the Gemara he quotes. Very interesting that he quoted this Gemara in Cholin. It says, this is Cholin 6b. It says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Zeruz, son of the father of Rabbi Meir, testified before Rabbi Yehuda Nasi about Rabbi Meir that he ate a leaf of vegetable in Beit Shan without doing Trumos and Maestros. Why did he do that? Because he held that Beit Shan is not part of Eretz Yisrael. And Rabbi Yehuda Nasi permitted all the products of Beit Shan based on this. The problem was that his brother, Rabbi Meir's brother, came and said, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's brother, they came and they united against him and said that in the place where your fathers and the father of your fathers treated untied products as forbidden, you're going to treat it as permitted? In other words, why you're going to change? The minhag is not to do like this, and you're going to regard it as you don't need to do Trumos and Maestros? And Rabbi Yehuda Nasi interpreted this verse to them, the pasuk, and he broke in pieces the copper serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the children of Israel burned incense to it, and it was called Nehushtan. They took this, the serpent, and they had started using it like as idolatrous. And so then the Gemara asks, is it possible that they were doing this and Asa, who was a righteous king, did not get rid of it and Yehoshaphat didn't get rid of it? It had to remain until the time of Chizkiyahu. Didn't Yehoshaphat and Asa get rid of all this bad stuff? And the Gemara says a famous expression, it's that it says his ancestors, room to achieve prominence. And he says, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, I too, they've left me things to achieve prominence. What this means is, to put it the way I put it, I guess, is that not everything is taken care of in previous generations. There's some things that we can build and do great, even though it wasn't done before. And what Lieberman is saying, the fact that's a proof that not everything in our tradition has been set in stone. Makom hinichu lanu, that we have the ability to also do things to make our mark. And here we're making our mark by, yes, we're doing different than the previous generation, but the siddur we're going to create is going to be more relevant. And then he elaborates on this, but that's his important point. So ends the book of Eliezer Lieberman. His part is called Or Noga. We'll see what the Chassid Sofer has to say about that. And the other part is Noga Tzedek. Here we have the first generation reform putting forth a halachic justification for reforms, which in theory you could imagine that Poskim would accept it had they wished. I mean, the sources are there. And this debate's going to be not so much, not entirely about halachic sources, but about a larger ethos. What type of Jewish community do we want? Now, in the second generation, I guess if we keep going, we get to the second generation, once the reformers are told that they're outside the fold, they no longer even need to bother with halacha. This is a one-generation thing where they're trying to justify halachically reforms. Okay, so what about the response of the Orthodox, who will, they're only going to be called Orthodox later in a century, but we'll call them Orthodox. It wasn't slow in coming, and it doesn't come from Hamburg, from Berlin, it comes in Hamburg. By the second decade of the 19th century, Hamburg Jewry had become quite secularized. We know that attendance at religious services had shrunk. Rav Rafal HaKohen, he was the Rav there. If you recall, Shaul Berlin had attacked him in his book, Mitzpeh Yachta'el. He resigns his post in 1799 as the Rav of what they call the triple community, Ahu, Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. Why? Because the government had withdrawn his right to excommunicate Jews who violated the law. The rabbi always had the right, or the community had the right. In Hamburg, it was the rabbi. So if you can't excommunicate these sinners, keep them in line, Later, the excommunication is completely useless because they're going to make their own shuls. But he chose to resign. After his resignation, there is no rabbi anymore, no rav, I should say, of Hamburg. Instead, the community is controlled religiously by three elderly dayanim who are completely out of touch with the younger generation. Now, Michael Meyer, in his book on Reform Judaism that I told you about before, described how at this time, right at this time, the early 19th century, there was a religious revival, Christian religious revival among the Christians in Hamburg. And this was also imitated in the Jewish world. There was a religious revival, but the Jews did not want to return. They weren't returning to the old time religion, traditional religion. They wanted something that spoke to them. They wanted something that would be in line with their feelings of being part of the modern world. They wanted practice Judaism, but they didn't want it to offend their moral sensibilities. They didn't want it to offend their theological beliefs. They didn't want it to offend their relationship with non-Jews. You tell me I can't eat non-kosher, but then how am I supposed to get along with the non-Jews? And I'm not talking about people necessarily ate pork, but just to eat. When Raphael Cohen was around, if you're found in a non-Jewish restaurant, let's say eating, even if you're eating salmon, let's say something which is 100% kosher, he could put you in cheirim for entering it. Whatever, they didn't want this. So these, and very soon you'll see, and many of them were not at all observant, but I'm just giving an example of some who were even traditional. These reform-oriented Jews began meeting every Sunday morning, not Shabbos, Sunday morning, in a privately financed Jewish free school. And they would sing hymns in Hebrew and German with a small organ. They had plans to open up a temple like the one in Berlin. And indeed, in October of 1818, they opened up their temple and they began now holding services on Shabbos morning there. The Bima was in the center. There was a balcony in the rear for the organ. There was no machitza, but the men and women sat separately. We know that until Isaac Meir Wise, later in the 19th century in Albany, New York, they always sat separately. And we know from the testimony that we have another example of reform as a form of kiruv, that people who hadn't been to synagogue in years were coming to the synagogue because it appealed to them. And it's like what Chabad does. People are going to Chabad now who are conservative and reform, but they haven't been to synagogue in years because they find their synagogues boring. Chabad, they find it interesting and exciting. The Hamburg Temple Prayer Book is the first comprehensive reform liturgy, reform sitter. There are still references, for whatever reason, to resurrection and angels. I guess you could interpret that symbolically, but the sacrifices are omitted in some places. I'm going to read you later, hopefully soon, what the Dayanim have to say about this sitter. There's a translation of a small section of it in Plaut's book, The Rise of Reform Judaism. In Shabbos Musaf, they describe, well, I don't have to read it. They instead of describing like we have in Musaf, the sacrifices, it's all done in the past tense. And they say, instead of the sacrifices, which you commanded, accept our prayers. Now, had Chazal made that sitter, there's nothing reformist about it. We could imagine a sitter that says, instead of the sacrifices, because we don't have sacrifices, accept our prayers. But that's not what the sitter says now. Look at Musaf, what it says. So they replaced it, but they did a lot more than that, as we shall see. They weren't consistent. I can't explain why. So they left some references to sacrifices, just like the return to Zion. They took out a lot, but they left some in. There was a non-Jewish organist, later Reform, they don't care about this, they're not Shomer Shabbos. It could be a Jew, but at this moment still, even if the people were not observant, most of them, still the temple was supposed to be in accordance with observance. That's, we see that not in Reform synagogues, but in conservative synagogues. You could have a conservative synagogue where no one is observant, or even an Orthodox, you have a Chabad where no one's observant, but of course the synagogue has to be kosher. This synagogue would create a great deal of controversy. Why? The synagogue was officially part of the Jewish community. So if you're part of the Jewish community and you want to open up a synagogue, you need to have the community's approval. Some board members opposed it. And of course, the Three Dayanim were opposed to it, to this Reform synagogue. But the community leadership as a whole wanted to strike a compromise. I don't know the details of what the compromise was. What I do know is that the members of the temple refused and the traditionalists refused. So I guess there would have been some compromise that you leave, take out some prayers, leave others in. Whatever it is, both sides refused to compromise. Now, the temple, although it was part of the community, the members of the temple said that we're a private institution financed by its members. We pay taxes to the general community, but this is our own synagogue. Therefore, they said, oh, we don't need to, you can't control us. Not the community board, not the Dayanim. None of them have jurisdiction over us. On the other hand, the traditionalists, the Dayanim and the traditionalists, saw this as just another shul, and therefore it's under the authority of the community. And if they don't listen, they can shut it down. Well, the Senate of Hamburg had a Senate, what we would call a town council, I guess, city council, was forced to get involved because they were besieged by petitions. And they issued a statement that the Hamburg Temple, I guess they were, I don't know who lobbied them better. I mean, if they were lobbied this way or they were bribed, whatever it is, they issued a statement that the Hamburg Temple is not a synagogue. It's rather a place for public edification. And its spiritual leaders are not rabbis. They're not even preachers. Rather, they're teachers. What this means is that if it's not a synagogue, the community has no authority over them. And they're not in rivalry. This meant that the new group could do what they wanted. It's a legal fiction, obviously, because we know it's a synagogue. It's true, they didn't have any rabbis, but we know it's a synagogue. But by saying that it's just like an educational institution, then they could do what they pleased. However, the traditionalists, the names mean something. I was at a very big wedding, a beautiful, beautiful wedding last night in Borough Park. And what you have in Borough Park in... you have all these yeshivas, and they build out these giant basements, and they have simchas there. And it's a way of bringing in money. But there's something else to that, because in New York, it was explained to me yesterday that the garbage is collected from yeshivas. It's collected for free. If it was a private place, then they have to pay for garbage. And that saves them a couple thousand dollars, I guess, a month. So what they do is, if you have it, all the garbage from all the simchas, they could put it out as part of the yeshiva, and it's collected, and it's legal, I guess. So, I mean, it's because they're calling it, it's not a catering hall, it's a yeshiva room that's used, or whatever. So that sort of legal fiction was done in Hamburg as well. Now, obviously, the traditionalists were not happy about this. They wanted to have people regard the reformers as outcasts. And the Three Dayanim issued a decree. The decree said that... it's forbidden, absolutely asur, to alter the prayers, even in the slightest, even to take out one of the Yom Kippur Kans or anything like that. They said you can't pray in any language other than Hebrew. You can't have a musical instrument played in the shul, even if a non-Jew is playing it. And they said that as long as, in their public letter, which I'll read some sections in a second, as long as it was individuals who were not observant, they didn't speak out publicly because that's their business, private individuals. But now that they've created an institution, a synagogue or whatever they call it, a place of public edification to spread their heresy, they must take action. And what did they do? They sent out letters, one letter actually, but sent out all over Europe. And the responses to this letter were published in this work, called Eile Divrei HaBrit. Later, when we go through this work, I'll read the title page and summarize it for you. But before we get to this work, Eile Divrei HaBrit, which is never was a rare book, because the Orthodox would continuously, they could always, you could print it. It was not like No God Said It that became a collector's item. But first, I want to look at what the Dayanim of Hamburg have to say, because in their letter, they say, first of all, that a lot of people are irreligious now, and we want to protest, but we can't protest because what you have is a new phenomenon. they can't control anything here. They don't have the use of the cherem. The people are free. I think every one of us doesn't want the rabbis to be able to punish us. We don't want to live in communities like that. We shall see if we get to it, or if Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is the one to actually argue against everything we're going to see. The way that these rabbis want to shut the reformers down and persecute them. Hirsch's whole approach is that this is a mistake. And in the modern world, we have to make religion appealing because of what we offer, not try to control them. This is not medieval times anymore. So Hirsch is going to agree with this approach that the government shouldn't be involved. But the rabbis are bemoaning the fact that they cannot control matters anymore. It's a new phenomenon, where Jews have the freedom to follow the law or not, and the rabbis can no longer control it. But they still thought that they could find some allies in the Senate of Hamburg. And that's through this Ela Divrei Rebbe, which we'll look at, which is also published in German, Judeo-German, for the masses, and then will be translated for the Hamburg Senate. They wanted to, first of all, show those Jews who were interested in rabbinic authority that don't believe these reformers. They're not really following Judaism. That's why you have it in Judeo-German, because the Hebrew, the original letter, is only the Talmid Chacham can read. How do the masses know anything? They have to read it in the Judeo-German. But also, they wanted to show the Hamburg Senate who was upholding the religion, because as we've seen before, Judaism is an accepted religion. It's a legal religion in Germany. However, if it's not considered Judaism, if it's some sectarian form of Judaism, it's illegal. And the Hamburg Senate will shut it down, and we will see exactly how this happens. And the Dayanim thought that if they could show that the reformers were not following Jewish tradition, that is, they're not following Judaism, they're following some concocted religion. And that's the language they use, and we have the same language today. You all know, if you've been to yeshiva, you know that no rabbi in your yeshiva is going to say that Reform Judaism, Reform Judaism is a type of Judaism. They say that that's not Judaism. That's it's something made up. It's a distortion. So that's what you see the Hamburg Dayanim say as well. Remember, the government doesn't force you to be religious. You don't have to observe. You can be indifferent to all religions. However, you can't open up a religion that's not recognized. You have Catholic, you have Lutheran, you have Jewish. You can't open up a Hindu temple, and you couldn't open up some sort of new Christian sect. We shall see how that changes later on. There were certain recognized religions. So therefore, if you have a new prayer book and a new approach to Judaism, you're not really Jewish. Halachically, you're Jewish, but you're not practicing Judaism. You're sectarian. And that's why the members of the Beit Din wanted to show that in such detail the changes that they were doing, because if it's a non-recognized religion, the government will shut down this temple. And that's what they wanted. So I want to now, I'll read and summarize for you some of the things said in this letter. The letter appears in, it's never did very brief, but it's also in the Tshuvas of the Chasam Sofer. I'm forgetting now here. The letters are in response. I believe that it's also the letter. There's a letter at the beginning of, I'm looking at Ela Divrei Abrit. We're going to look at that later. But what I'm looking at now is the letter that goes to the Chasam Sofer. They wrote him a special letter, and perhaps they wrote the same letter to all the other Gedolim, and they say as follows. This is number 84 in Likutei Tshuvos Chasam Sofer. He says that we have in our community in Hamburg people who are Yireim Ushleimim, religious Jews, that they listen to the rabbis. But nevertheless, it's been a number of years now that the plague of Haminut, the Mitsa Kitsineyam, that some of the leadership, the rich people, they become heretics. They violate the Torah, and they're Machale Shabbosos Befarhesia, public Sabbath violators. The Emiyadeinu Michos, we can't protest. That's bad enough. And he says even worse, now people have come to make a synagogue for them, a Beis Tefillah, on Shabbos and Yom Tov, it says L'Shabbatos L'Moedim B'Levad, only on Shabbos and Yom Tov, because these people don't come to davening during the week. Just Kafi Anaseh Berlin, just like was done in Berlin. And then he goes on that they've put out a new siddur for Shabbos, and only for Shabbos, in which they changed many things in the siddur from that which we've received from the earlier tradition. So, for instance, in Birkas HaShachar, the only thing they have in there, it says, is a L'Kai Neshama in German letters. None of the brachos that we all know, all those brachos, those are gone. Yeah, L'Kai Neshama Shalasata Bita Horehi. You see that that's like a very spiritual prayer, God, you've given, and they say it in German. But nothing else, it's all gone. And so they skip then from L'Kai Neshama, they skip all the Pesukah de Zimra. Except for Ha'uas Hashem Min HaShamayim. You have to figure out like what spirituality they saw in the few things they kept. And they sing it with Nigun Ha'amim, the non-Jewish tunes, using an organ. And then they say Yishtabach. And then they say Hakol Yoducha Ad Ein Karkacha. And that's it. They skip Kel Adon. Then they get into Tisparach Tsurenu. And then they skip in Ahava Rabbah, they skip the part that says from Sem Yachal Be'er Kanfos, that is, will be brought back to the land of Israel because they don't believe in a return to the land of Israel. Then they say Shema, they skip Emes Ve'yatziv, they skip Tzur Yisrael, and then the Chazan begins out loud with Shemona Esrei, and they say Kedusha, but then he says the things they skip in there, and then they read the Torah, but they don't do Haftarah. Instead of the mafter, they have a drasha. The preacher gives them words of Musar, but it says in these words, they also criticize the sages, Chazal. And then the Chazan does Musaf. He says in a way that they invented on their own, Nusla Chadasha, which is not Ashkenazic, not Sephardic. They invented their own Nusa. They say that God should accept our prayer in place of the sacrifices, like I mentioned to you. They take out that we're going to go up Besimcha or Atzeinu because they don't believe in a messianic hope anymore. They Nira Ba'olol, we see clearly She'ein Chafetzim B'Vias HaGolol Osu Tzion, that they no longer have any desire to go to the land of Israel. So then he goes on. He says that they go on. The Dayanim say, we all have to rip kriya, tear your garment when you see such a sitter. And because these people are now trying to bring in into their terrible things Jews who don't know any better. And then it goes on that we've sent to the leaders of the community that they should make a declaration in all five synagogues that we have here in Hamburg that anyone who is a Jewish forbidden to pray from that Siddur. We also made a prohibition that you cannot pray in anything else other than Hebrew. And as I said, you can't use an organ, even with a non-Jew, and you can't change any minhag. I don't know why you have to do all the other ones, just to say you can't change anything. But that's what they said. And he said, and we brought this, the Dayanim say, we brought this to the government, Asrara. But the heretics are telling the government that our psak is not in accordance with the law. That is, the reformers said to the Hamburg Senate that this is bogus. There's no law saying we can't pray in German or that we can't use an organ by a non-Jew. So they're going to need then all the great rabbis to affirm that what they're saying is in accord with halacha. And then it says they've recently printed this work, Noga Hatzedek, in the city of Dessau. And it has no haskama. That is, there's no haskama from the local rabbi or any of the people in the vicinity. As we saw, the haskamot are from these other rabbis. And then he goes through what it says in Noga Hatzedek. And then he says that they say the government here, they're men of seichel, of wisdom, and of learning. They said to us, Dayani, we have to bring proof from the great sages that what we say is correct. What does the Hamburg Senate know? Two Jews are arguing. So he said, but we have to bring proof. So therefore, we ask you, the Chosm Sofer, to write for us a tshuva as soon as possible, that you should agree in three things with us. One, no one has the authority to change the nusach. Two, no one can permit davening in any language other than Hebrew. And three, that it's forbidden to use an organ even if played by a non-Jew. Then they say, even though we know that you're allowed to daven in any other language, he says, even though we know that you can daven in any language, nevertheless, you don't change it. What the argument is going to be is if someone privately wants to say it, but as a group, you don't change it. And he says in particular, in this case, why this isn't like, you're going to tell me, well, in Salonika, the women got together and they davened, they all prayed in the vernacular, Ladino, and then Shmuel Abua, we mentioned that you have a minion there where they don't speak Hebrew. So you do the whole davening, including Kaddish and Kedusha, you do it in the vernacular. But here the Dayanim say, this is different. Shekol Kavanoseim, their entire intentions are, they just want to be like the Goyim. The whole reason why they want to do this, and the Dayanim are right. They want to, well, they're right in, they're not completely right, because they did want to bring in, through these reforms, they wanted to bring in the people who had left the synagogue, who didn't feel comfortable in the traditional synagogue, the people who were going to be assimilating. But how did they want to bring them in to the synagogue? They wanted to, the way to do this was to make the synagogue like a church, with the organ and with everything. So the actions, they're right about the actions, what they wanted to. And he said, so then he says, perhaps you can put forth a decree together with your father-in-law, the Rav of Pozna. Now, I'll tell you a little bit next week about this relationship, the special relationship between the Chasam Sofer and his father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. They're the same age, but that's his father-in-law. Said, you should speak against these heterim that are in this book, No God Tzedek. And we're going to see what the Chasam Sofer has to say next class. Why? And then when we get what you say, we will present it before the Sarara, Yarum Hoda, here, because, and he says, we don't want you to give reasons. You know, what is you can't start giving Talmudic reasons for the government. Don't give reasons, just Hadin HaPashut. Just give us easy, yes or no. Is it permitted or not permitted? And perhaps, he says to the Chasam Sofer, if you do this, and others do this, and we show this to the government, Ulai al yedei zeh yevutal shama batei hakneset shelhem, maybe then we can shut those synagogues down. Because if we can show the government that this is forbidden, the government will shut them down. This is what, when we're going to see this repeated again and again. This is the sort of thing that Hirsch was very uncomfortable with. He thought it was not the proper approach. And I can't imagine that there's anyone listening to these classes who thinks that in a country, you know, a Western country, that we want the government shutting down non-Orthodox synagogue services. We all understand how that could backfire, and it's just not appropriate. I wonder, though, about Israel. I think there are plenty of people who believe that in the state of Israel, if the government could have that authority, I think they would agree to shut down the non-Orthodox services, because they probably believe in quasi-theocracy. But Hirsch would be opposed to that, and that would be a disaster for all sorts of reasons, that not to mention the fact that it would turn the Jewish world against Israel, but it's just, that's not how you bring Judaism in the modern world. You don't shut down synagogue services of people you don't want. And then he goes on. He says, they say, the problem is that today, Bavarosen Rabin, we have Machale Shabbos Profesia. We have public Sabbath violators, and they say to the Christians, Shemachzikim Bedasi Hudis, Kehochim Besa Knesses. You have a situation where you have public Sabbath violators who are saying to the non-Jews, the government, that we too are Jewish and we go to the synagogue, we're no different. And we have to show them that this is false. And he says, Ubifrat, ki kol yemei ha-shavua sagor masagor beis ha-knesses shelhem. He says, it's phony anyway, the Dayanim say, because their shul was closed during the week. They only open it up on the Sabbath. It's like a church. Although churches are not just open on Sunday, but I mean, the point is that it's most people only go on a Sunday. So these people, these are once a week, Jews, and it's for kakafta de lo manach tefillin. They don't wear tefillin because they don't daven during the week. And then he ends, and it's signed by the Hakatan Baruch or Mayor Rosh Basin. Yeah, so it's for all the members of the Basin. He represents them, and we're going to see next class. First of all, we'll see the Chasam Sofer's reply, and then we'll start going through Ego Divrei Brit, and we're going to see some arguments, really the creation of Orthodoxy. If you ask, what is Orthodoxy? How does it differ from traditional Judaism? We are going to see the creation of Orthodoxy. Some have said the Chasam Sofer himself is the creator, but others have said that Orthodoxy is created in this Sefer, Ego Divrei Brit, because there is going to be difference between Orthodoxy and Ego Divrei Brit and what comes before. Of course, they're all Shomer Shabbos, Kashrus, all that, but Orthodoxy is more than that. It's an approach and a way of responding. Well, we'll get into that as we go further. So let me take, we've already reached the end here. I'm going to tell you a story next week about Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Chasam Sofer, which none of you will believe, and I don't believe it, but you'll find it interesting. So let me see the questions and the comments here. Barry says, who wrote the Shirim of the Rav? This was Rabbi Reichman, Herschel Reichman, from Englewood, I believe. He teaches at YU. So it's his notes. Rosh Shiva, YU.
I know he's from the Bronx boy. But he had him way his order. He gave, when I was there, the Ron Kahn gave said the Chazar Shirim. Before him, I think it was Herschel Reichman. I'm not sure.
I think this might have been from Rav Schechter's notes. I don't know if it's his notes, but he put it together nicely, and there's some fascinating things in there. Rabbi Shunau says, because of industrialization, 19th century, it affected Ashkenazim in Europe, but not Sfaradim. Yeah, we were asking why do you have people not dying in childbirth? That could explain why you have bigger families. And the Sephardic world, the Arab world, which is then the Arab world, because no Spanish Jews, the hygiene was low. You had all sorts of diseases and epidemics. It wasn't as advanced in the Ashkenazic world. That's how I see it, at least. Someone privately emails me that he thinks that in Italy, the Haftarah is read even if there is no minyan without a brachot, which is what we saw from Rabbi Adler. But they don't take out, in Italy, they don't take out the Torah. Although I think this is actually a dispute. I don't think all the Ashkenazic rabbis would assume that that's okay, because if we only take the Torah out when we're supposed to read it. I know Rav Moshe was opposed, for instance, for taking out, having a separate Parsha Zohar reading. The Rav had no issue with it, because you can take a Torah out to learn. If you want to take out a Sefer Torah and learn it, we take out a Sefer Torah, the Bar Mitzvah, we can practice. But Rav Moshe held that we only take it out when it's a minyan and it's a chiyuv, and there's no chiyuv for women in Parsha Zohar. Contrary to what everyone is indoctrinated in today, there's no Chiyav, no Rishon, no Achron. This is a Chiddush of Nassim Adler. So Rav Moshe held, this is what Rabbi Aaron Felder records, that you shouldn't take it out. With that logic, then you shouldn't take it out to read it if you don't have a minion. But that's Rabbi Adler and his Basin said you can. Rabbi Kelman says, I believe the Rosh suggested to not daven Ma'ariv on Motzei Yom Kippur. That I haven't heard. I don't know. In my shul years ago, they made a change, but then they moved it back that they wouldn't. A lot of people think that you can't eat to the shofar. The shofar is all of a sudden, that's halacha. There were people who were not religious years ago. They would wait outside shul. They couldn't come into daven, but they'd wait outside. They'd be fasting, wait to hear the, they come for Neilah, or either they wait outside or they come for Neilah just to hear the shofar. So what happens is then you have all this chaos. Everyone, they go eat. There's no Ma'ariv. There's no Havdalah. And then you get to go to the food and all the good stuff is gone. So, but really, the reason they wanted to stop this is because the chaos. So the rabbi of my shul, his name was Herschel Cohen, he said, he came up with a suggestion, which they then did for a few years, and then they stopped, that you don't blow the shofar until after Ma'ariv. Now, this creates a problem also because, let's say, the women who don't want to be in Ma'ariv, they want to go eat, you're delaying it. So Adler's solution makes sense. You finish Ne'ilah, let's say 10 minutes or 7 minutes before. You can finish Ne'ilah before. And then you, here, I'll read you what he says. Here. All right. Okay, I have it here. Then you start Myriv, and you finish Myriv like we do, at least in my town. You start Myriv like 7 minutes or so before Shabbos is over, and you finish with end of Shabbos. That is, you don't start Myriv when Shabbos is actually over. And he says here, I'll read it what he says here. Have it here. Yeah, he says you can't get rid of it. In many synagogues, the Myriv is read with the majority of the congregants are quitting the place of worship or nervously preparing to do so. And then you got Kiddush Levana, and then people, they want to eat already. He says that, what's his remedy? He says, I propose that the sounding of the shofar be deferred until after Aleinu, an arrangement that's in accord with Torah or Chaim, etc. The evening service is to be commenced some little time before nightfall by the same reader who is officiated in the Ilah, and it's to be read with the same solemnity and impressiveness as the other services of the day. It's always a problem, Yom Kippur. You just finished all your tshuva, and then the first tefillah you're doing it super quick. That's not exactly what you should be doing. The reader must be careful not to say Havdol until after nightfall. The entire service is then to conclude, with the shofar and the closing of the ark. So that's a possible solution, and that's what we do every Shabbos. We start Myriv, and we before Shabbos is actually over, so we finish it. Why do you have to dafka finish Ne'ilah when the holiday's over? It's a good suggestion, and then you start Myriv, and then no one's running out, and no one's running to eat, because they know that it's not over yet. Now, in my shul, that's not what they did. They finished Ne'ilah after it was over, but they just didn't redo Tekiyas HaShofar. So the Hamonam, they think they haven't blown shofar, I can't eat. Anyone who's a bit of a chacham knows that if it's already dark, I didn't hear the shofar, I still can eat. But that was what Rabbi Adler suggested. iPad says, didn't Rabbi Yehuda Nasi diminish the dimensions of Eretz Yisrael to help with the hardships of the Shemitah year? You know, I can't recall, but this would tie in, I guess, to what we saw just now. Rabbi Shimnow says, the Jewish Welfare Board produced its own Sidurim and Kitzurim in Tefillah. Yeah, well, for soldiers, you can, and we do have Kitzurim, forget soldiers. They used to put in the Siddur, the abridged one Esrei, the Havinenu. And we're going to see some abridgments. Before the Reform came around, abridgments were also acceptable. And even today, sometimes abridgments are acceptable. We'll get to that. The question is, who's doing the abridgments and why are they doing the abridgments? iPad says, authority of community, doesn't that equal state funding via the community apparatus? The way it would work is that the... it wasn't. Today or later, by the time you get to Hirsch, the situation was that you pay taxes, and part of the taxes would come back to the community through the government. But at this time, I believe that you pay tax to the community. You didn't pay to the government, which then came back, and the community had the authority. Chaim says, thank you, Chaim, for the Shulchan Aruch, Halos Hashem is the most important of Psukim Zimra and the last one to be skipped to fight. Which is why that was the one they said, the only one they said. iPad says, is the Orthodox community here fighting a Jewish group, cutting off their nose to spite their face? I don't know if it's cutting off the nose to spite their face. What they're doing is they're using a procedure which is going to come back to bite them in this way, because the reformers very quickly assume control of the communities. And then the reformers start persecuting the Orthodox. Wait till you hear what the reformers did to the Orthodox, how they persecuted them, refused to repair the synagogues, shut down synagogues, shut down schools. And the Orthodox are going to complain and they're going to go to the government. The truth is that the reformers were doing the exact same thing that the Orthodox was doing, when it just depended whose ox was being gored. And Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch will come on the scene and establish a principle that we don't bring the government involved with this. Not only that, his great-grandson, Mordechai Breuer, used the Hirschian approach and said this: if Hirsch was around today, he'd say the same thing about the state of Israel. We cannot use the state of Israel to enforce religion the way it does. The Mizrahi learned this. They had no problem enforcing religion when they were running the show, when they controlled the chief rabbinate. Now, all of a sudden, the Haredim control the chief rabbinate, and the Mizrahi doesn't like it anymore. So they want to have their own rabbis, and they want to have Tzohar, and they want to have their own conversions and their own kashras. Hirsch would have said to them, You think it's okay when you're in control, when you're controlling it, and you're telling the Haredim what to do in the irreligious? That's okay. But now all of a sudden the Haredim are in control. Now you're screaming that it's not fair. If it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And Hirsch, as in so many other areas, saw very clearly that this is not the way to run Judaism in the modern world. We don't gain anything by forcing people, by putting pressure on people. We have to make it appealing to them. I think in America and Canada, we all realize that. The Kiruv organizations all realize that. For some reason, in Israel, and it's not even the Haredim. The Haredim are not the worst. The worst were the religious Zionists. The Haredim, until they took over recently, the Haredim really didn't care that much about this. It was the religious Zionists that insisted on enforcing religion. And it never works. Rabbi Yellen says the same approach to have the government shut down inappropriate shuls was only a repeat of what Mostagdin did vis-a-vis the Hasidim in appealing to the government. Absolutely correct. There's a temptation. And in pre-modern times, we understand it. But as you move into the modern world, you should recognize it got so bad that I don't know how far we're going to take this series. Maybe if we get to part 145, I'll speak about during the Nazi era. What do you say when you have Orthodox rabbis, and at least I know of one or two, who say with the Nuremberg laws? The Nuremberg laws said two things. One of this, that Jews are not citizens. And the other is it banned the marriage between Jews and Aryans, or even sexual relations. Intermarriage was a huge problem in Germany. And you had at least one or two, there was some feeling that this was a good thing. At least now we'll be able to stop intermarriage. And Isaac Breuer, Hirsch's grandson, said that this was such an example of unsophisticated thinking. If any government in modern times is going to ban marriage between Jews and non-Jews, civilly, ban marriage. This is not good for Jews and Judaism. They do not have Jewish interests at heart. And seeing a positive upside to this, that, you know what? Hey, the Nuremberg laws, we wish we were citizens, but at least now the reform can't intermarry. That's just, as Breuer said, this shows just no sophistication at all. IPAD asks, how much of the community sitter in Hamburg differ from the Siddur of Amram, Rav Sadia, or Machzor or Vitri? Well, in terms of length, not that much, but they took out the sacrifice, they took out the return to Eretz Yisrael, they took out any idea of messianism. So in that sense, they put in German prayers and hymns. So in that sense, there is a big difference. It's not only about the length of the service. Rabbi Kelman says that when he was a rabbi, the first Yom Kippur, I think YC means Yom Kippur, right? They mean YK. More than half the shul walked out after shofar before Ma'ariv. So I asked the senior rabbi if we could daven Ma'ariv, then blow shofar. He agreed, and the following year, 100% of people stayed for Ma'ariv. The idea came from my father, Zal, who did this so that 2,500 people in a traditional service shul would stay for Ma'ariv. I don't know why in my town it stopped. They did it, I remember, as a kid. And then maybe because Rabbi Cohen passed away. And it's not the general practice. And the people might protest it. Because the women, they go break the fast. And they why should they stay in for Ma'ariv? But it creates commotion. And a lot of men leave also. The thing is, Rabbi Mazuz writes that, you don't need to wait till Yom Kippur to do the Kiddush Havana. I think it's the Chidah already mentioned. You do it a few days before. I showed this to one of the people in my shul. I said, I think we should do this practice too, because Yom Kippur, there's a famous story after Yom Kippur. Rav Yaakov Moshe Cohen, Lesson. He was the Mashkiach at the yeshiva. One Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is finished. They finished with Ne'ilah. They finished with Ma'ariv. And they blow the shofar, but the Mashkiach says, stay a minute, stay. He wants to give him some mussar as they start the new year. And Rav Shmuel Lazer Volk, this is a famous story. Rabbi Rakefet mentions it. I even think it's his book. Rav Shmuel Lazer Volk screamed at him, sit down. You know, they have women here and children. They're hungry. So it was like he embarrassed Rabbi Lessen. And but to show you the tzitkus of Rabbi Lessen, when Rav Shmuel Lazer Volk needed a shidduch for his daughter, Rabbi Lessen helped him get the shidduch. But what Rav Volk was from Telz, the Telzer was saying that you know, you could do the Musser another time. We just finished a fast. Now's not the time to delay it with, although you have tzaddikim, people like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, it's famous that after Yom Kippur, everyone went to eat. He stayed in the Beis Medrash for a little while because the attitude was at least someone should be learning. He can wait another half hour or so before he goes to eat. Privately, someone says, doesn't the Aruch HaNer require women to hear Zohar pretty late at night? Yes, he does. And but he's post, he's based on Nassan Adler. He quotes from Nassan Adler. But it all comes from Nassan Adler. And then you have plenty of people who say it, but none of the Rishonim say it. And this was never the practice in Hungary. It was never the practice in Poland, in the Sephardic world. It's become the practice. But it begins with Nassan Adler, and I think the Minchas Elazar also, I think he also likes the Reb Nassan Adler, but it's a modern thing. It's not, none of the Rishonim say that. Harvey says his show also, they read, they blow shofar after Tekiyas HaShofar. Does everyone blow shofar? Do the Sephardim blow shofar at the end also? I don't know how widespread this minhag is. I was giving a class today and for a group from London, and they were telling me that at least in that Sephardic group, they don't say the bracha, Shepatarani, when you have the bar mitzvah. There's a little question. It's not a Talmudic bracha, so do you say it with Hashem's name or not? But they didn't even know what I was talking about. I think Iraqis do say it, but at least the ones I had, they didn't know what I was talking about, that this blessing to release me from the yoke of this child. Okay, well, the question someone privately says that about the Israel boundaries for Shemitah, it's the recent Sugi Mivomos a few days ago. Check it out. That was due to the extreme famine and wanted Meisar Ami to be effective. Okay. And the final point someone said, iPad, the Orthodox Siddur from Rav Amram Sadia, not the Reformers. I thought your question was, does the Reformers Siddur, how different is it than the Siddur from Rav Amram Sadia, because it's much shorter and you get rid of all the piyutim and everything like that. That's what I thought your comment was. If you take the Rambam Siddur, their Siddur, you finish High Holidays much quicker. But this is part of our tradition. It's there's accretions that come on and they're very important. And that's what davening is, I would say. So Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Thank you. You know, your thing on Kiddush Levana before Yom Kippur reminds me how I'm sure Rav David Zvi Hoffman has the shaila, if you can get married in the Sefer Tumei Tshuva. So he says, what's the problem? Get married and maybe you get another mitzvah before Yom Kippur. It's such a great mitzvah for Sefer Tumei Tshuva. And then he writes, and I got married on a Sefer Tumei Tshuva on the 6th of Tishrei. It's in Melamed Lohol. I just found it such a cute tshuva. Says, and I got married during a Sefer Tumei Tshuva, and you know that's what I did. I don't know anybody that would make a wedding during a Sefer Tumei Tshuva. Anyways, okay.
Well, why not? Why wouldn't we? Because it conflicts with
busy. With no, nothing to do with Frumkeit. It's with it's like making. I have a friend in Israel who got married years ago the day after Yom Kippur. Like people, and who in America is going to make a wedding between Yom Kippur and Sukkot? You don't do that here. That's fine to do. It's wonderful to do. Just
well, you could have an old-fashioned wedding with a small group. You can't have 200 people. People don't
right.
Want
to that's what I'm saying. I never heard. I don't know anybody who got married during a Sefer Tumei Tshuva. It's not. There's
you're
weddings.
You're not going to get married right before Pesach either.
You said you were at a fancy wedding last night. Yeah, and for the next week.
But would you get married 2 days before?
No, that's nobody went married 2 days before Pesach, right? We changed. I mean, we listen. They used to get married Friday afternoon. The non-Jews would play the band at night, but okay, things are different. Anyways, okay, looking forward to next week, and I'm looking forward to class 145 in 2.5 years. Okay, I mean, we did 53 on your book, so, you know, what's 145 on Reform, Conservative, lots to discuss. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, tomorrow, of course, Rachel Sharansky-Danziger at 11 a.m., continue her series on Sefer Shemot, and Alex Israel concludes his series on Eliyahu Hanavi, Prophet of Fire. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. And then Wednesday, Ari Mermelstein, continuing our Pesach series. Did the wise son own a Haggadah? That's this Wednesday morning at 11 a.m. 11 a.m. for Ari Mermelstein. Then Dr. Sokolow, 8 o'clock at night. Thursday, Shuli Mishkin, and then the Parsha Sheva, Rabbi Eitan Aviner, and then my Shir on the Siddur at 9 o'clock Friday morning, and Rabbi Liebtag, 11:15, how Tehillim understands Magid. Okay, we look forward to learning with you and your friends. Please invite a friend. Everybody be well, and let's hear good things, and thank you very much. Laila Tov, everybody.
Laila Tov, Toda Rabah.
Vakasha. Okay. Yes, yeah. Okay.